I'm Greg. I'm one of the elders. Brooks is in South Africa for the next 3 weeks, so I'm going to fill in for a couple of them. For those of you that are disappointed in that, they need nursery workers. You can feel it. Go ahead. Leave now. I won't be offended. That's fine. So we have been going through the book of Luke. If you're new, if you're a visitor with us, started a long time ago. We've been going through it one verse at a time, and right now I can sing and dance. Anyway, we're in chapter 19, dance, yes. Nursery's going to be crowded then. But anyway, we're in chapter 19 today, and we're going to be continuing on. How many of you guys have gone on summer vacation? How many are looking forward to summer vacation? Raise your hands. Yeah. In our house, we've got about 3 weeks left. We're getting prepared for summer vacation. We've gone down to the same spot for a number of years. And some of my older kids will be going to a camp, and it's a camp that I actually worked at and have very special memories. And while I was preparing for this message over the last couple of days, there was a particular memory that came to mind. It's Great Adventures in Car Parking. This particular camp, the sessions were 26 days long. So moms and dads would drop off their kids for 26 days. And they would have a particular emphasis during these camps, like in regions or something like this. And I remember for the second session that was there, they said, all right, we're going to be, this particular session coming up, we're going to be having some of the suburbs of Dallas, Texas is going to be coming. And you saw some of the veterans roll their eyes, and I said, well, you know, I was a newbie then, you know, what's going on? They said, this will be the session of 26 days with boatloads of spoiled rich kids. That's not to say that all rich kids are spoiled, but just through observation, what we saw at camp, yes. So we went through 26 days of trying to minister to spoiled rich kids. Ah, very good. And at the end, one of the last nights, all the parents would come in, and they'd have presentations for the parents and things like that. There was a job that the director of the camp gave myself and another counselor whose name was Gary. And it's like, you guys go up to the top where everyone comes in. There's this gravel road that goes a little bit more than a quarter mile down to the camp. And he goes, when the cars come in, you make them park up there and they have to walk down. Now, if they bring grandma, drive her down, drop grandma off, but you cannot park down there. Do not let anyone go down there and park. There's no room to park. If they come down there, you're going to tell them, you're going to have to turn around, just come back up. So everyone that came in, you got to park up here. You mean you got to walk? Yes, you're going to have to walk, sir. Particular gentleman came in, and even at a young age then, I was in graduate school, I learned where spoiled rich boys get their attitude, and it's usually from dads, okay? This guy came driving in a car that was more expensive than my house, okay? He came in, and Gary saw him, and Gary said, sir, you can't go down there. You're going to have to park up here. Gary was very nice to the gentleman, and it was getting dark, and he goes, I'm not going to walk down there in the dark. He goes, sir, there's no room to park. And he goes, I don't care what you say. I'm going to go where I want to. Gary's very patient with this man, and he said, sir, you can't go down there for these reasons. We just ask that everybody parks up here. And he said, son, I don't want none of your snide remarks. Don't be a jerk or an idiot. I will do exactly what I want to do. Don't tell me what to do. This gentleman failed to realize that Gary was a Navy SEAL. Gary had just finished a couple tours of active duty. Gary had done missions. Gary had blood on his hands. Gary was a new believer, and Gary was getting chewed out by a snotty rich guy. And I'm in the back just kind of going, if Gary goes off on this guy, I am not going to get it in the middle of it, because then they're going to have two dead people. Okay? And I'm one of them. But I marveled. I just kind of go, this guy does not know who he is messing with. He has no idea. Gary finally said, sir, if you want to drive down there, you go right ahead. But when you come back up, I will help you find a place to park your car. Guy drove down. About 15 minutes later, he came up, still mad. And Gary showed him a place to park, And when the guy was walking down fuming mad, he said, "Sir, and if there's anything else I can do, you just let me know." Now, most people would look at that and just say, if they didn't know Gary's real nature, they would probably say, this guy is a wimp and he's just letting people walk all over him. Do not mistake humility for weakness. You see, because that's the very same thing that happens when many people start looking at the person of Jesus Christ. They have no idea who they're messing with. Many times when you talk to primarily men, primarily younger men, about Jesus, they generally will have this kind of an idea, and they'll say, you know what, I think of Jesus, he's kind of this metrosexual guy. When I see pictures of him, his hair is usually long and very well kept. He appears to be a little pale, a little frail, a little thin, a little malnourished. He's probably a vegan. You know, when I see pictures, you know, he likes sheep and kids. I understand that he's poor, walked around with a bunch of guys that left their jobs. They probably couldn't hold a job, whatever. He talked about God and about being nice, and, you know, when finally he went to Jerusalem, he got his face kicked in, and they killed him, you know, and people somehow follow that. And I think many people would correctly say, I don't know if that's someone that I can really follow. I don't know if that's someone that really would capture my heart and my attention and just say, oh yeah, I want a piece of that. I recently heard one gentleman say, he said, you know, one of the problems with modern day Christianity in the church is that they're filled with Ken dolls. You want to explain? He goes, Ken dolls. Yeah, they're those guys who like to worry about their hair, their bleached teeth, their wardrobe, but when you strip off all their clothes, there is nothing that resembles anything towards manhood at all. That's why I don't like church. You know, if that offends you, I'm sorry, but the nursery can use workers, so feel free. But when we look at the scriptures, we really see that Jesus is something far different than what many times people's perceptions are. The more we get to know Jesus in the reality of how the scriptures portray him, there is something just altogether shock and awe. That's altogether shock and awe. Now, if you're a guy that likes movies like Braveheart, Gladiator, those kind of movies where the good guy likes to come in and he loves to win and he's totally in control and, you know, God stirs something deep within your heart when you watch those kind of movies, I got a text for you. I got a text for you guys because it's about God's plan. It's about God's plan. And what we're going to look at today, let's back up. This is the portion in Luke where Jesus is going to be going into Jerusalem. He's going to go into Jerusalem, and this is, many people call this his triumphal entry. I tend to refer to it as his untriumphal entry because this first coronation of him as king does not exude a whole lot of triumph. His second coronation, when he comes back as king, that's going to be something to behold. So when we want to look at Jesus, I think like when we're making plans, one of the wise things to do is when we're making plans, let's begin with the end in mind. Because Jesus is going to be coming again. And for those who believe, well, you know, I think Jesus is a pacifist, well, you're somewhat right because after he destroys all his enemies, there will be peace. Jesus loves peace, and he's going to get it by destroying his enemies. This is what Jesus looks like currently. It's in the book of Revelation, chapter 19. And it says this, John, he had this vision, he goes, and I saw heaven open. All right, the curtain is pulled back, and this is Jesus in heaven. He says, and behold, a white horse, he who sat on upon it is called faithful and true, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire. His eyes are a flame of fire. See, this is when kids go to a sibling and say, Dad wants to talk to you. What's he want? I don't know, but his eyes are a flame of fire. This is when colon's empty and people run. This is not, we're going to sit down and have a good talk, okay? His eyes are a flame of fire. Upon his head are many diadems or crowns. He has a name written upon him which no one knows but himself. He's clothed with a robe that's dipped in blood. His name is called the Word of God, and the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses, and from his mouth comes a sharp sword so that he may smite the nations. All the people of the world, the nations. And he says, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This is Jesus the Christ, full of power, full of glory, in all of reality. And he is waiting for the day when he will come back and he will destroy his enemies. He will then be crowned king of the entire world, and he will rule it with a rod of iron in perfect peace with all of those who love him, adore him, are saved by him, and call upon his name. Now let's go back to the first century. Jesus, this same Jesus, only he's got a different uniform when he goes into Jerusalem. You see, instead of a robe that's dipped in blood, he's wearing a robe that's dirty from the roads. Instead of riding on a white horse, he's going to be riding on the colt of a donkey. Instead of being surrounded by an angelic host and his redeemed people all dressed in linen, fine and clean, ready for a war, he's got a bunch of unemployed disciples and some poor people following him, singing songs. When he goes into Jerusalem in the first century, he has no crown upon his head, but when he comes back, he will be wearing multiple crowns, showing that he truly is the King of Kings. And you see, it is power without the external glory, but it is the same Jesus that will become riding into Jerusalem. You see, Jesus is working out his plan. All the way back in the beginning, in Genesis chapter 3, when sin came, and God declared that there would be a plan, that there would come the Messiah who would crush the head of the serpent, sin, and set people free. That plan, as we look through the Old Testament, is being played out over and over and over. And then specifically, Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is coming to a very focal part in the book of Luke. If you look back in Luke chapter 9 and verse 51, it's where Luke records that Jesus set his face towards Jerusalem. There's an intentionality. There is resolve. He is going to go to Jerusalem because he has business there. And from chapter 9 all the way up to where we are now in chapter 19, we see this road trip that Jesus is taking, the miracles that he worked, the things that he had, but now he is coming towards Jerusalem. This was the mission place that he wanted to go to. And make no mistake, Jesus is going to Jerusalem to pick a fight. Jesus Christ is going to Jerusalem to pick a fight with evil. He's going to pick a fight with evil. Over the next several weeks, when we look at this time during the Passover, when Jesus is in Jerusalem, not only this week, next week, and the other weeks when Brooks and Dave Kirk are presenting it, watch and see how much Jesus Christ is in control of the whole situation. He's directing the subjects of the conversation. When someone wants to introduce something, he's changing it. This is what we're going to talk about. Even when they come for him in the garden to arrest him, he tells the soldiers, he goes, let these guys go, you came for me. He is totally in control. Even when he's brought before the religious and the political leaders, even though he's getting beat and he's getting scourged, he is totally in control and he's working his plan out. Because these religious leaders And these political leaders, they have no idea who they're messing with. They have no idea who is standing in their midst. So let's go on. Let's take a look at our text today, chapter 19. We're going to pick it up, and it says, after he had said these things, these are the things that Brooks has been talking about earlier, talking a lot about finances and money. He goes, Jesus, was going on ahead, ascending to Jerusalem. And it came about that when he approached Bethphage and Bethany, near the mount that is called Olivet, he sent two of his disciples, saying, go into the village opposite you, in which, as you enter, you'll find a colt tied on which no one yet has ever sat. Untie it. Bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Thus you will speak. The Lord has need of it. And those who were sent away went, and they found it just as he had told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, why are you untying the colt? And they said, the Lord has need of it. So he's going to Jerusalem. The Passover is coming. There's an estimated that about 2 million people will be in Jerusalem at this time. It is crowded. And of course, a lot of Jews want to come to celebrate the Passover that do not live in Jerusalem. So there's this massive movement of people starting to come into Jerusalem. And so he is traveling with his disciples, with his followers, and as they're coming, they come up, and he said, look, there's a couple small towns. They're getting close to Bethphage and Bethany. Let's think of it like this. Big event in Iowa City. Let's say Iowa State football game. Okay? We could go into the analogy of the sheep led to slaughter, but we can't because they won last year. But anyway, there's this massive amount of people that are coming into the town, okay? And Jesus, as he's getting closer to one of the smaller towns, let's say like Oxford, they're coming into Oxford to go, hey, guys, this is what we need to do. Go into Oxford, you'll find a Casey's, okay? In there, there's going to be this pickup truck. It will be an F-150. Look inside, the keys are there, all right? Get in, you two, and if anyone comes up and says, what in the world are you doing? Just say, the Lord needs this. Okay? So they come back and they go, gosh, we went there and here there's this F-150. The owners come out. They said, you know, this has never been used in the fields before. It looks real nice. It's got some Brad Paisley CD. You know, everything's going well. Peter doesn't like it, you know. But they go in, they get in. The owners, plural, come out, say, why are you untying this donkey? The Lord has need of it. And then there's nothing more said. Now, I don't know, if someone comes up to your driveway and starts to get into your car, what are you going to say? Yeah, you know, but they simply say, can you imagine doing that? Go here, go to this guy's farm, you have no idea who he is, you'll see a donkey, just untie it. And it's the middle of the day, it's not night. I mean, it looks like, are you encouraging, like, you know, robbery or something like that? He just goes, the Lord has need of it. Can you imagine? The guy comes out, what are you guys doing? The Lord has need of it? Okay, fine. Go ahead. Now, why would he say that? Doesn't really say. It could very well be. My speculation is that reputation of Jesus is all over the place. He's done all these miracles. People have heard about him, and these guys come, and it's like, the Lord has need of it. Oh, take it. You want to take it? They take it and they bring it, okay? It's not just a donkey. It's the foal. It's a colt. It's never been ridden on, you know? I mean, it still has that new car smell, you know? It's new. And he takes it, and he's going to use it. You ever made plans? Even your best made plans, what do they often do? They fail, okay? You ever get frustrated by making plans? What about the specific details of the plans? We're trying to plan a summer vacation. Maybe some of you are too. I know last year when we planned summer vacation, we've gone to the same spot for years and years and years. And last year, all the little details, they hardly ever worked out. All these things that are totally out of our control, they change. It changes everything that we did. if we can't plan with great detail a week of our life, how can we plan our life at all? When you look at this text and how Jesus is interacting with his disciples, I mean, I'm kind of amazed. It seems like a small thing. Okay, he's talking about a donkey. He says it's there. They go get it. I would be utterly amazed, especially when we know the power of Jesus Christ. Let me ask you this. Is God in the details or is he not? Is he really near or is he far off and far away? Does he know us intimately or are we on our own? And can he be known in all the little details or are we just left to try and figure it all out on our own? Jesus Christ is working out his plan that he had from eternity past, and it is down to the most specific details. And it's to help us to grasp and understand that he wants to be intimately involved in all the little details of life. He is sovereign, and he controls them. And do we want to be like the owner of the young colt that's never been ridden and said, go ahead, take it, I trust you? Or do we want to be like maybe another type of young donkey that's never been ridden and someone wants to control it and it bucks? Many times we're like that. We want to buck because we want our independence and we want it our way because we believe that we know what's best in the details of our life. And we can't even figure out tomorrow. And yet God, in his providence, in his power, in his revelation, is trying to show us he knows all the details, he's in control of all the details, and he wants to be involved in all of the details of our lives. See, he knows. He's in control. And he cares deeply. So some would say, look, it's just a little donkey. Why such a big deal about a little donkey? Yeah, he goes on. Luke says, and they brought it to Jesus, the donkey. They threw their garments on the colt, put Jesus on it. And as he was going, they were spreading their garments on the road, and he was now approaching near the descent of the Mount of Olives. And the whole multitude began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles which they had seen, saying, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. He comes into Jerusalem and the mob is growing. The followers are starting. There are some people who really want to honor and obey Jesus. There are some who are just going to go, look, here's this Jesus that we've heard about. Let's go see what's going on. There's some people probably just getting caught up in mob dynamics, and they go, looks like something fun over there. Hey, let's go. Hey, people are saying this guy's the king. Yeah, hey, king, way to go. But we see that people are saying this. They're starting to yell, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. This is some scripture. It's a song from Psalm 118, and it's what the Jews would sing to a warrior general, after he would come back from a great victory, and they would say, blessed is our King who comes in the name of the Lord. Some of these people maybe have no idea exactly what they're saying. But what they are doing is they are proclaiming that Jesus Christ is the King. Some are wondering, is he the Messiah? Is he going to be the King that will reign over us? And he's coming in, and they're showing their respect and their obedience and their submission to him. They're throwing their coats on the ground, let him walk over it. That means, yes, we'll let him rule over us. Some really meant it. Some had no idea. Some were just getting caught in mob dynamics. But they're saying that he is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, what's, I think, really interesting about this, how much Jesus is in control, is that There was a prophet. There's a prophet, Zechariah. About 550 years before this event, he talked about the Messiah, that the Jews were waiting for, the one who would be their deliverer, the one that would come as king. And he prophesied and said, this will be a sign of what the king will look like. And Zechariah wrote this. He said, greatly rejoice, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He's just. He's endowed with salvation. He's humble, and he's mounted on a donkey, even a colt, the foal of the donkey. Not just the donkey, the offspring. So specific. Some people are starting to understand that, and they go, could this be the Messiah? Could this be the one? Now, when you look at this, people, please don't get confused. The issue here is not the donkey. The issue here is Jesus. The issue here is not so much Zechariah and his prophecy. The issue is Jesus. Because he's the one who prophesied to Zechariah. He's the one who's coming later. And the one who's coming is not just a nice guy. The one who's coming is a warrior. And as I said, he's a king. He's endowed with salvation that we as people desperately need. It does say he is humble, but please, once again, do not mistake humility with weakness. Humility is power that is under control. Readily available, but totally under control. And that is our great King, our Messiah, Jesus Christ. He is into all the details of life. And while he's working out his plan, he's also in control of the schedule. He's also in control of the schedule. Luke goes on to write this. He goes, and some of the Pharisees and the multitude said to him, teacher, rebuke your disciples. And Jesus answered and said to him, I tell you, if these become silent, the stones will cry out. So he's coming in and they're getting loud, they're singing, and some of the Pharisees, the religious leaders who have for so many chapters and for so many years do not like Jesus. They want to get away from him. Jesus is taking people from them. They're losing their thunder. They're losing their credibility. They're losing the people's interest. They're losing the control and the power that they so desperately want. And so they basically said, hey, Jesus, will you just tell your disciples to shut up? And Jesus says, truly I say to you that if these guys remain silent, the stones will cry out. They say, what in the world is, you know, talking about stones, is someone? What is this all about? The stones will cry out. This is a very specific answer to prophecy. Very, very specific answer to prophecy about the Messiah. Let me take you back here. In Daniel chapter 9, Daniel is praying about the future of Israel. An angel comes and says, I'm going to give you a schedule. I'm going to give you a timeline about the deliverance of Israel. And he says this. He goes, 70 weeks, which is translated sevens. So 70 sevens have been decreed for your people, that's Israel, and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. The angel came and said, there's a timeline I'm going to give you. This is when righteousness will be revealed. There's going to be an atonement for iniquity. Seal up, prophecy, it's all going to come to an end. And he says, so that you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat. even in times of distress. And then after 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Let's do a little biblical math here. It says, from the issuing of the decree to the rebuilding of the wall until its completion, there would be seven sevens, 49 years. Okay? From the completion of the wall to the announcement of the Messiah, the Prince, there will be 62 sevens, or 434 years. If we take the Jewish calendar, 483 years, that's a lot of days. Okay, you want to schedule that far out? What are you going to be doing in that 174,000 days? I don't know. I'm still working on Monday. Okay? In the book of Nehemiah, we go back, and in chapter 2, we find that Nehemiah wants to go back to Jerusalem. He wants to rebuild the wall. King Artaxerxes issues a decree, and he says, you can go back and you can rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. We find out that it does say in the scriptures, if we take the Jewish month, translated to our Gregorian calendar, that issue was given on March 5th, 444 B.C., 49 years later, it was totally, totally completed. 173,888 days later, when we convert from the Jewish calendar to the Gregorian calendar, 365.25 days, throw in a couple of leap years, except those years that end in a century, we come up to March 30th, 33 A.D., the announcement of the Messiah in Jerusalem, first century A.D. Now, I don't know about you, but that just impresses my socks off. That I still don't know what I'm doing tomorrow, and yet Jesus Christ has a schedule and he keeps it. He said the Messiah would be announced. And he's telling the religious leaders, you know what? If these people don't say anything, creation will. Because somebody is going to say something. Because he's in control of all the details, and he's in control of his schedule. There's no fudge factor. There's no down days. He is on top of it, even for 174,000 days. Is he near or is he far away? Is he involved in our lives and his creation, or is he distant and uninvolved? Is he in control, or are we subject to random events? Let me ask you this. How good are you at keeping your schedule? How good are you at keeping your schedule? Do you control your schedule, or does your schedule control you? Ask some of those ladies that go to MOPS, Mothers of the Perturbed and Stressed, okay? I know what it's like to have a bunch of little kids. I know what it's like to have what sometimes is like, are you dictating the schedule here, Dad, or are you merely just responding to it and trying to keep as many oars in the water and trying to keep as much chaos from happening? We have a hard time controlling a couple days with a couple people, and yet we want to say, I want to control my life. Jesus Christ, who is so involved with all the details and with the schedule, and yet some of us will not even give him a second look because we have the wrong idea of who he really is, and we have no idea who we're messing with. Who has a better plan? Who has a better plan? I mean, first of all, he's God and we're not. We should stop right there, but we're not. He knows all things. We need instruction manuals to put together our kids' toys. And guys, do we ask? Do we really get them out? Do we get out the instruction manual? What do we say? I can do this all by myself with parts left over. And that's when we try to communicate to our wives, we're just being good stewards of that which God has entrusted to us. So if we ever get another jungle gym bike, things like that, we've got extra parts. I'm just planning ahead. He understands us intimately. Half the time we can't figure ourselves out. He has power over the events of our lives. We're weak, even on steroids. He knows what's best. At best, we're just guessing. His sovereign hand is holding all things together, and we're just trying to get through the day. Does that sound like your day? Because that's a lot of my day. That's a lot of my day if I am really, really honest. He's in total control. Sometimes we're in total denial. He's working everything out. He's into the details. He's got the schedule. And he's very, very, very serious about it. It says, and when he approached, he saw the city and he wept over it. This is why sometimes I have a hard time why people say, oh, this is the triumphal entry because he comes in riding on a little donkey with a bunch of unemployed guys and he gets there. The Pharisees tell him to shut up and he starts bawling. You see this word wept, it's not, it doesn't mean he's just crying. The word wept for like when Jesus came and Lazarus had died and it says Jesus wept, means that tears came. This means weeping audibly like a child, sobbing. Have you ever been in a place where you've been sobbing? Not just crying, but that audible sobbing because your heart is completely ripped apart. This is what Jesus is doing right now. Why is he sobbing? He goes, if you had known in this day, 173,880 days after the decree, if you had known that on this day, even you, the things which make for peace, he came to make peace, but now they've been hidden from your eyes. He's not saying that a cloak has been put over them. It's not that Jesus is blocking their view. It's just that their hearts are hardened. They aren't even seeing it. He said, for the day shall come upon you when your enemies will throw up a bank before you and surround you, hem you in on every side, will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Jesus is declaring right now, I came, you rejected. You don't want me. You either want me to feed you, you want me to take care of the Romans, you want me to offer you a place to live in safety, but you want control of your own life. You want nothing more than a sugar daddy that'll take care of you, and yet you will not bow and you will not honor me as the one God that he truly is. And so what he's saying, he goes, now what's going to happen? The days will come upon you, your enemies, the Romans, they're going to come, they're going to destroy your city. And in 70 AD, 37 years later, that's exactly what the Romans did. They surrounded the city. They set fire to the temple. Look how specific Jesus said. He goes, he's going to level it to the ground. The children within it, they will not leave in you one stone upon another. So thorough was the destruction of Jerusalem that Jesus prophesied about and that happened. It's amazing. Because what had happened is that the temple, Herod's great temple, all these gold artifacts, all these precious metals, and people who had wealth would sometimes hide their gold in the walls. So intense was the heat, so intense was the destruction, that much of this gold metal melted in the stones. And the Roman soldiers came, and when they found a pile of stones, they would level it out. If they found a boulder, they would break it because they were looking for gold to take back to Rome. They literally took boulders and made them into pebbles. If they found a pile of stones, they kicked it out level because they were looking for gold. So thorough was the destruction. So incredible was the loss of life. Jesus takes his plan very, very seriously. And to reject it is very serious as well. Jesus Christ came to Jerusalem to pick a fight with evil. And he had every intention of winning. He came to pick a fight with evil and to pick a fight with our greatest enemy. Because our greatest enemy was our own sin. Our greatest enemy was hell and eternal damnation. And he came with the view that that is the enemy that he's going to pick a fight with and he's going to win. And he's not some Ken doll that when you strip him down naked, there's no vestige of masculinity at all. Because when he hung naked and people were able to gaze upon him, this is not a Ken doll, this is not a passive man. This is not a victim, this is a victor. This is not something that is pathetic, it's powerful. Because he even said himself, the one who's in charge of all the details, the schedule, and serious about it, he said, no one takes my life. I lay it down on my own accord. He went there willingly so that the penalty of our sin, our condemnation, could be paid. The Prince of Peace came the first time so that we can have peace between us and God. And the rebel heart can be broken. And the rebel heart can be transformed. This is what he came to do. Now the second time, he's going to come again. And he's going to conquer then all the remaining enemies that he has. It'll be quick. It'll be violent. It'll be thorough. And there will be peace. And he will slaughter all his enemies. All of those who believe that their resume is somehow superior to his. Somehow that they feel that they can make better plans, create a better schedule, be the center of their own existence, and look upon Jesus as something other than the supreme king, ruler, and warrior of the universe. And they will not bend their knee to him. And I would say to you, if you're here today and you have not done that because you thought that Jesus was just a nice metrosexual guy with good hair and that he said just be nice to people and get along and that there was a nice philosophy of just doing good and maybe sometime all people go to heaven, I would hope that you would understand that the scriptures say something totally, totally different and that he wants you in all the details, all of your schedule, all of your life. And he wants to change you and he wants to transform you into the image of himself. He will come again and he will win and he will bring finally peace. See, what is he waiting for? What is he waiting for? How many of you saints have been Christians for 20 years or more? Raise your hand. Yeah. Get him up there real high. Come on. How many of you, and have you wanted Jesus? When are you coming? Okay, people, how many of you have been Christians for, let's say, a year or less? How many of you come to know the Lord just within the last year or two? Raise your hands. That's why he's waiting. That's why he didn't come 20 years ago. That's why he didn't come last year. Because he wants you. He wants you to be part of his kingdom and to enjoy the life that he brings. Let's pray. Father, thank you for sending not just a sacrifice, but a warrior. Thank you that you're in control. All these things. I mean, we just touched the tip. But my God, I ask that you would work in our hearts that we would become extremely serious about you and your kingdom. Some of us are on really tough roads right now. A lot of bumps, a lot of discomfort. Give them hope and encouragement that it won't last much longer. Let us labor and work and enjoy a relationship with you and the tasks that you've given us to do. Lord, make your presence known here in this community, using your people for your honor, for their benefit, and that, Lord, our joy that's found in you may indeed be full. And we thank you through the name of Jesus Christ. And all his church said, you are dismissed.